So, as I was saying, there are two ways, really, of working, at least two ways of working with the sanctuary. One in this, where we just sort of fold inwards and go in an inner journey into the sanctuary with it, into the sanctuary within us. And that's, I suppose, a more contemplative kind of form. But there's also the way, the one that we have just done is, if you like, uniting ourselves with our own deepest self. So this phrase that Ernest Butler used, and I've used all my life, which goes, "Now do I descend into the inner sea, whose waters rise and fall within my soul. Let the inner elements be subdued and still, as I immerse myself within the living waters, and emerging therefrom unfold from latent stress the potent living image," and in this case the phrase is, "the body of prayer and blessing." Now, the body of prayer blessing, which is also the body of light, which we have looked at in this, which we've looked at earlier on in these different forms of the body of power, the body of love, the body of wisdom, which then comes together into this composite form of the body of prayer and blessing, is a, if you like, the image of our deepest nature. It's a transitional form that locates us within, locates us between our personal nature and our divine nature. So when we arise in that form, we are this, and that this form can be, it can take any shape. It can be tiny, it can be vast. In this case, it goes into vast shape because we're creating our identity with the generative mystery that creates the universe. So we arise in this vast form, standing as the pillar which holds the universe in balance. And then, as we perform the Kabbalistic cross, this is a ritual of creation. So we reach into the unmanifest, and so we reach beyond the known into what we might call the dark light or the negative light, not in an unpleasant way, but in the sense of being unmanifest. And what we find there, and this is an image I got from Ernest many years ago, which always works for me, the idea of seeing a black cat in a black room. It's partly because I had black cats when I was a kid. We had this cooler, you could always tell when the cat was in the cool house. No light, but you could just see. So there's a way of in the unmanifest, there's a way of perceiving with the potential of something that is to be. So the potential that is perceived in that moment is the sense of the negative image of four thrones, empty thrones, and a source point. And as we say Ate, which is thou, it is that, that's the word of activation, and bring our hand down, we bring the light from its unmanifest form into manifestation. So the middle pillar, the light comes straight down through us, but also the four vortices of the four thrones, which are the, if you like, the extension in time and space of the manifest universe, descends like spinning vortices with us, forming itself into the sense of the universe as the sanctuary, and ourselves standing like the Archangel Michael as the priest at the altar of the universe. And then, as having brought the light into expression, we balance it by Vegebura, Vegedula. We bring the opposite into balance. We establish it as a dynamic, rhythmical working form. So we bring our hands together, Leolam Amen. Now and forever, we establish the sense of the centeredness of the universe as it continues to grow and manifest in space and time. And for a moment, we are identified with everything. In the next moment, we are ourselves receiving the echo of all of that, because we can't stay at that kind of level without doing ourselves in. But we retain within us the echo, the memory of that kind of that deep identity. And then from there, we then start to explore the different directions, the in this case the direction of fire. And we will go in through the weekend, we will explore the other three directions. So by the end of the weekend we will have worked with all four. And we won't always do it in this ritual form, we'll also do it in a contemplative form. So the idea behind this is that so we are identifying ourselves with this work of the magician, which is that sense of the enabling the manifestation, the bringing of things into balance, the generation of new life and light. Now what happened with that is we began with Mikael, we begin with the south, with the place of fire and the winged lion, who takes us into the courtyard of fire, and then increasingly takes us into smaller and more concentrated spaces, which in a sense are the four levels of the Tree of Life. So we're in, first of all, we're in this kind of fiery kind of landscape, which becomes the open courtyard of a temple. We then come into the next step. So this is the world of Asiya, and it's where you find the elemental spirits. We next come into the covered courtyard, and this sense of the angels as great pillars of fire. These are the Malachim, this is the world of Yetzirah. Then the smaller room of the Archangel Mikael, which is the world of Beriah. And finally we come into the smallest place of all, which is the singularity of fire. The single letter Yud, that is the essence of fire, the essence of the divine will. And from that place we are then sort of turned around when we embrace the all four levels and then bring these qualities back into our sanctuary, and through the chanting of the name bring that dynamic energy of fire into our sanctuary and into our world. So what we're doing there is working with the singularity and the multiplicity. So the work, you know, the work of this path, the work of the magician, is to work between the mystery of the unchanging stillness, the mystery of the non-dual world, and the moving, changing, ever-evolving and growing world of manifestation. So the magician is the mediator between these places. And it's interesting, I'm going to say I've just been to Egypt, so Egyptian things are on my mind. But one of the things that's interesting about the, not just actually Egyptian temples, but the Temple of Solomon, some of the Greek and Roman temples that follow, is that you often get this, you get this kind of division from the outer to the inner. And it's very particularly clear in the Egyptian temples, because you start off in the very big place, and if you go into an Egyptian temple, it's very subtle, so it's not always easy to notice. But you start off big, you get smaller, and you start low, and you end up high. So it's like you convert. It's like the perspective converges. So that the roof gets lower, so beyond the temple, if you like, you've got the sense of the whole universe. Then you have the first pylon, and then you have this open courtyard, which is bounded but the sky is there. Then you come into a covered courtyard, which is smaller again, and then an intermediate room, which is often where the divine bark is held, and then the Holy of Holies, which is the tiny, tiny room And the statues you find in the Holy of Holies are very small. They're not great. They're not the great monolithic statues that you might associate with Egyptian statues. So, what's being shown in that architecture is the, if you like, how things, how shape and form comes out of the singularity, the single point. One of the interesting things about Egyptian tradition is the whatever is in the Holy of Holies is the divine. It has a particular shape and a particular quality because of whatever is being worshipped. So if it's the goddess Hathor, there's a very particular kind of quality that's different from the quality that comes out of the house of Amun-Ra. But each of the divine, each of the Neteru, the Egyptian idea of a god is also an interesting thing. It's the hieroglyph for a divine figure. It's a flagpole and a flag. So it's this pillar, like that holds everything up. And then you have this flag that flies in the air, that moves, that twists, that shapes, that responds to the universe. So each of the Neteru are expressing a particular kind of energy, a particular aspect that's brought it. But the Neteru are all one. They're all part of the great Ennead, or the great family of the Neteru. So this sense of unity and multiplicity is absolutely fundamental to Egyptian tradition, but fundamental to all inner tradition. So particularly as we work at this level, we work really between the multitude and the singularity. We work with our particular distinct nature and our universal nature. So that sense of coming into that center line, taking shape around that, embracing the particularity of our shape and our effect upon, and then the particular house that is our house, that is, if you like, fractal, nested within all our other houses, which ultimately are the house, is the universe itself. And if we look at this, if you look at the book of prayer from the Book of Tokens, it starts off with one and one only am I in essence, changeless, indivisible, concealing within my being the 10 lights of divine animation. The 10 lights are, of course, the 10 sephirot of the Tree of Light. So this sense of both, immediately right at the beginning, there is the oneness, and then there are the 10 lights, there are the 10 sephirot. In this, my unalterable unity am I supreme, none is equal to me. Yet though I myself remain unchanged through eternity, my power manifests itself in ceaseless change. So we're presented with that sense of the unchanging, unmanifest essence that is constantly manifesting through ceaseless change. And this phrase, I am he who lives. I am life itself. Without mind, there is no life. I am the essence of mind. The essence of mind is will. Of my will, all created wills are reflections. And the essence of that will, what is it but desire? So this is, often in spiritual things, desire is thought of as a wrong thing. Here we're being shown the divine desire that life should live, that life should grow. I am life eternal, I am the eternal longing for manifestation, because of which I bring forth the shining worlds. For this I do divide myself, becoming two. So this is this movement from the non-dual to the dual, because of the desire that the world should be, that life should manifest in time and space. And then it goes on to say, of these two, the first is the crown of my primal will. So this is the place. This, my superior nature, stands above the world, which flows forth from my act of knowing, my gnosis. So there's this part of the divine that is above and beyond, or within and beyond, the movement of change. But it says further, but even this unchanging part, is to my inmost essence as something outside. So the place that I have that is kept there, the crown, is not my deepest nature. My deepest nature is the unmanifest. Once I divide myself, into the crown and that which proceeds from the crown. And then, but within and beyond that, there is something deeper that is remains undivided. It is to me as Bet, my house, for I am within it, and it is an emanation from me. Nevertheless, I fill my dwelling place. Hence it is written, the supreme, which is the undivided place, is distinguished from the crown by name only. In my supreme abode, I stand as the onlooker, and because of my unwavering contemplation, the stream of manifestation continues. So this is the sense of the divine, the omnipresence of the divine being with us, with every, so that phrase you get in the Bible, of not a sparrow falls out of the sky, but the divine knows it, the divine experiences it. So this sense of the complete accompaniment of the divine contemplator in every activity, in every act, everywhere, every when. Whatever exists has its beginning in my will, continues in my will, and by my will comes at last to its appointing end. Other than this, there is no other will in all the universe. Yet in it, all creatures have their part. So it's not saying that we're robots, because the will is also a dialogue, a conversation. But what it's very clearly saying is, look beyond the shapes, beyond the opposites, beyond the separations, what you find most intimately. If you enter into the most intimate place of your heart, here you find me. Here you find the divine. From my substance, all things derive their substance. All that has form is built from my fourfold elemental manifestation. And this is where it works with the elements of fire, air, earth and water, which we've started to look at. In an endless variety of mixture and proportion directed by my will, these mingle together for the production of forms. They are transmutations of a single essence, and from their minglings are brought forth all things. So this is the way in which the singularities, the sense of fire, the radiance of fire, the flow of water, the expansion of air, the embodiment and crystallization of earth, from these principles, by being combined in infinite variety, all forms, all shapes, all energetic processes, all physical processes arise. Watching thus the multiplicity of existences proceeding from the single essence, I understand them in all their relations. I perceive their beginning, middle and end is in truth myself. Thus do I see that all things, whatever their appearance, because they spring from my own nature, are grounded in goodness. Goes on to say, my superior nature is reflected also in the mind of human beings, created in mine image. Know me, thus, as the source of all true will. Know me as the power to perceive objects, having the appearance of standing outside and apart from those who regard them. Wherever this power acts, whether in low forms or high, I only am its source and I am the knower. Not yours, but mine is the power of attention. Now that's a very powerful, interesting thing. The power of attention. So this is mine, this is the divine power. Not thine, but mine is the power of attention, of observation, of discovery, of the discerning of sequence in the operation of nature. In all this, and in the power of discrimination, my superior nature works through you. Happy are you if you can grasp this truth. For then understand that not your weak self, but my all-knowing mind, looks upon the world through your eyes, if you have the faith to let me see. If we can allow the divine to look through us. You'll overcome the confusion of your senses by devoting them wholly to my use. Not you, but I shall then discern the weight and shape and texture of the things you touch. Not yours, but mine shall be the knowledge of scent and savour gained through nose and tongue. And when I use your ears for hearing, they shall be attuned to the sweetest harmonies where they are now assailed by strident discord. So you shall become a partaker of the bliss of my experience of the universe. So what is being said here, as we allow this deeper part, this deeper self to work through our senses, we see, hear, taste, smell and touch with this divine consciousness, so that all sounds, even if they are to outer ears discordant, have a harmony, have a rhythm, have a sense of, have their sense of place.
Even Donald Trump.
Even Donald Trump, of course Donald Trump. Everything. I mean, that's the challenge, right? That's the extraordinary challenge of this prayer, that all things have their place. And if we can see in a particular way, if we can allow, in fact, actually, if we can just allow this deeper sense, deeper self, to see and hear, touch, smell, and taste through us.
Can you get us the words of that, Ian?
Pardon?
Is there a way of getting us the words of the poem there?
No, not really. It's really long, Rob. There's no electronic version of it. Right. You'd have to buy the book, probably, if you want the words. Obviously, it's recorded, so you can transcribe it, obviously, if you want to do that. Because I've read the whole thing out, so it's on the thing.
Yeah.
Sorry, somebody else was speaking. Was Andy, was it you? Or Penny?
Yeah, I was just saying, in a way, the poem is saying we must become hugely big. Big's the wrong word, but anyway, to be able to extend, to be able to embrace or hold whatever is happening.
Well, actually, it's saying almost the reverse, that we have to let go and allow that to do it through us.
Yes.
Okay. So we allow that, and then we are expanded, we are lifted up in a sense, we are expanded in that kind of a way. Yeah. Benny, it looks like you're going to say something as well.
Well, I'm struggling a bit with this poem because I wonder, do you think it's expressed in a rather old-fashioned way?
Oh yeah, completely. Well, this is a man writing in the 1920s, Ben. So yes, of course.
It comes from a sort of Christian context because I mean we're up here in the supernal triangle, talking about unification, and there's this long poem that seems to say, me and you, me and you, me and you, the whole time. And I completely understand the dynamic of that, but the way it's expressed seems to be quite divisive in a way. We can't become the divine whilst we're in this incarnation.
Well, no, you see, it's precise. The poem is very precise, Ben, because it's actually looking at the, because this path is the manifestation of form out of the, and it's the work of the magician that is working between non-duality and duality. So, of course, that is why it works about, why it looks at division and you and me and that and all of that. That's exactly the place.
Yeah.
Right, because this is, in a way, this, the work of the magician is exactly this, right? It's that movement through Bina, from Keter, from the unity of Keter into the multiple manifestations of Bina. Mm. So that's exactly, so it has to talk like that. That's the phraseology it needs. Because that's the work. That's the work of being the magician, is to be both the singularity and the multiplicity.
Yeah, yeah.
And to look at what happens when we address that, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a really difficult path, isn't it?
Yeah, well, of course. No, it's these deep paths, these high paths are very difficult. I mean, obviously, the language is also just an extensible fashion, because he was writing in 1920. Or she might even be before that. Let me just see when I was first published this.
Can I just ask, is what prevents us from allowing the divine to come in and be this, to flood us and be in us so that we can embody that? So is it fear that prevents that?
I think it's mostly fear. I mean, I certainly, that sense of feeling, of that sense of overwhelm that happens. Mm. And then contraction because of the sense of dissolving into the divine. Can we trust that? I mean, that's one of the challenges, I think, really.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, how would one know that it's the divine and not something else?
Well, that's right. That's the risk.
That you can let yourself, you can allow that process to unfold without contracting that, oh my goodness, I'm not sure what this is, or whatever.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? Because in that process of dissolving and opening, in order for that to happen, you have to let go of your known places, and that is not easy. You know, it's easy to talk about, it's easy to suggest, you know, spirituality talks about this, it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. I mean, a friend of mine many years ago, a wild psychologist from the Bronx called Paul Cohen, he gave a lovely illustration of this once. He said, it's like trying to pull yourself through a doorway while you're bracing yourself on the door jamb with your feet. I just think it's a really accurate description of what trying to surrender is really like. You know, because you're trying, I'm trying to surrender, I'm letting it in, and of course you tighten, but you're also pushing away. And of course, one of the reasons that image works, because at a certain point, you do that long enough, your body will let go, because you just go into exhaustion and you drop. And that's kind of, so this whole idea that you have in Judaism of Israel, those who struggle with the divine. And it's that image you have of Jacob struggling through the night with the angel. And who is overcome just before dawn. That's what surrender is really like, in my experience. Well, it's not the lovely opening. I mean, maybe for some it can be like that, but for me it's been much more that sense of struggle, can't let go, don't want to let go, can't let go, can't, push, pull, but then something mysteriously shifts, and then you're in it.
And if that manages, if somehow that process works its way through you,
yeah.
There's no guarantee that it will last for more than a moment.
Right? Oh, no, normally it only does last for a moment. But the usefulness of that, because that has happened, it helps you next time. Not a huge amount, but it's like incrementally that ability to sort of to let go develops over time. But normally, you're quite right, Pam, it just is for a moment, really, and then you're back again. Sometimes there are exceptional occasions where you find that state rest where you're staying for. But the most profound, my own most profound experience of it, went on for about a week, which was extraordinary. But it one of the things, the memories I take, not the experience, but one of the memories I take out of that was my understanding I had everything completely the wrong way around. And that, the, one of the realizations that lay, that reminds me that I'm still working with out of that is that it actually, I completely understood in comparison to the place I was in, I had reversed everything.
Right.
And I can't really explain it to you now because I don't have that consciousness, but I do have the very clear memory of that consciousness. So actually, no, Ian is wrong. It's completely the wrong way around. All your ways of understanding need to be reversed. And now that's, you know, it's a cognitive thought. Now it's not the realization, but it was a living realization for a little while.
Thank you. Can I ask something or
comment? You can.
So talking about and working out what this is, so I had a moment in the meditation when we connected with the Malachim, was it?
Yeah, the Malachim, yeah.
Where it felt like this place was where maybe like the inspiration from a song came, mm-hmm. or the inspiration for a painting, or...
Yeah, could be.
The something coming through from, I don't know, something bigger or the divine or somewhere else,
yeah,
it'd be manifested, and in this case I suppose in the physical, either through words or song, and also in the song something about, because we sort of in our group said something at the end, someone went ah, and we talked about how in the beginning of the Bible, they said, in the beginning was the Word, and then we sort of, I thought it was, and the Word was God. And then I think it could have been the Word was with God.
Yeah, that's right.
But so I've just got a couple of things in there. But one is a sense of this, when we get inspired in this inspiration, is that coming from this place or something working through in that way? And the other one, how does the divine connect with like sound or the word and what it says at the beginning of the Bible? And is that somehow that this word that was first created or the sound or the arm or whatever was something that first came to manifest, wasn't it, when the world was created? And I'm just wondering if
Okay, so start with the inspiration first. So the Malachim are the angels, in particular of Tiferet. Tiferet almost certainly is the place where that deeper kind, and you know, and the quality of Mikael as well, who is the mediator between the deeper worlds and the outer worlds. So the inspiration can happen much deeper up the tree, but certainly there is this mediation point in Tiferet that come that in. So if we think of the tree beneath Tiferet, where it connects to our imagination, to our mind, to our emotions, and ultimately to our bodies. So inspiration passes through the gate of Tiferet and then becomes formed, maybe as a song, maybe as a painting, maybe as a story, you know, maybe as a creative act of some kind, you know. So that's exactly what that happens. Your sense of getting inspiration from the Malachim feels, you know, spot on. In the beginning is the word, is the beginning of the Gospel of John. And this sense of, certainly you do get this sense in Kabbalah, not just in Kabbalah, but also in, as you say, in Hindu tradition, in the Vedas, the sense of the Vak, the word, that arises out of the unmanifest, that brings the manifest into being. In Kabbalah, of course, this is the name of the divine. This is it's called Hashem, the name, which is not a static word, but a conversation, which is a dynamic, resonant, energetic form. So Yud He Vav He, for example, is a process of creation. In fact, in the one of the ways of explaining or describing the Greek of in the beginning is the beginning of the word is in the beginning is the conversation, because in a certain sense what you see in the gospel of John is a. The Gospel of John, in a certain sense, recapitulates the first book of Genesis, where it talks about the creation of the universe. But in the Gospel of John, it says, "In the beginning is the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God." Another way to put it: in the beginning is the conversation, and the conversation was in God, and the conversation was without God, was outside God. Without the conversation was nothing made that was made. In the conversation was the light, and the light shines in darkness, and the darkness comprehendeth it not. So this is this place of division, this place of opening. So this place, sense of the name expanding, developing, growing, which is what the Book of Tokens poem is talking about. A man came from God whose name was John. He was not that light, but he came to testify of that light. And because the Gospel of John talks about the emergence of the Christ, who is the living light, who is the expression of the divine. And John, who in this case John the Baptist, is the forerunner of that light, who comes to testify, who comes to say that the light is coming to us. So, you know, it's a creation story. It's a Christian creation story, just as in Genesis, we're told, with blessingness the divine created Elohim created the world. So that's the Judaic version. In Hindu tradition, that sense of the Vedas, that sense of the arising of the Vak, V-A-C, which is the word which brings the universe into being, with the eternal Om. So most traditions have this sense of the creative word that brings things into being.
So why the word conversation? What the conversation between us and God?
Conversation between the divine. So in the divine, in every part of the divine. So it's not a static. Creation is not static. It's an ongoing interplay between the divine and all the parts of the divine.
Between us and the divine.
Between us and the divine, between the divine and us, between each, you know, between each atom, it takes us into this sense of the universe as a continual mystery of conversation, adjusting itself, readjusting itself, you know, a completely connected relational universe. So not static.
And so what's the significance of the word?
Well, the word is just the creative expression of the divine will.
It could be anything. It's not that the word is specifically.
It's not a specific word, right?
Not specific that the vibration or sound.
Sound is the echo of the primal movement. So sound is what we hear through our ears, that helps us, if you like, connect to the idea of this primal vibration, primal movement, really. Which we through our senses can describe as sound.
Can I say something?
Yes.
Because I'm really quite excited about this. Now, and so one of my questions is this what intuition is about? Is this what happens when I'm working as a therapist? And the bit that really excites me, is this what happens when I play the gongs and I don't know how they're going to play,
yeah,
but somehow it it comes through. Is that the meeting of these places?
Yes, completely, right, completely. These are the conversations, right? This is what I mean by the conversations. So when you're sitting with somebody, so let's take the therapist, sitting with somebody, there's a multi-level conversation going on at all levels, from spirit to body. And in that kind of joining, that mysterious conversation that happens, you say and do certain things, the other person says and does certain things, and that's part of the unfolding kind of mystery. When you play the gongs, absolutely that's the case. I mean, that's very literally the case, because when you're working directly with sound in that way, whether with a group or an individual, you're working with not just with the sound that you are generating, but the room that you're working in, the responses of the people to it. Now you're not doing that, you know, out loud, but that's part of the multi-level conversation that's going on.
That's so helpful, because it sort of makes sense of something which I couldn't understand and could dismiss a bit, it helps to make it more real.
Yeah.
I can accept the reality of that. That is happening. It isn't my imagination.
No, it isn't. It isn't. Right, and it's,
I have the same thing with a didgeridoo. It's the same thing. It plays through me.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Right. Yes.
Right. So that's that same thing. That right at the end of that poem, when the drawing talks about coming through our senses. So when you're playing the gongs or when you're playing the didgeridoo, it's not just coming through your senses, it's coming through your actions and coming through in relationship to whatever you're encountering there. Right, so that's why it's a conversation. So the divine through you is perceiving and responding. That's why it's a call and a response. Okay, so there's the call, the sound, there's the response which evokes another call, and so back and forth, it's that call and response.
Okay, thank you.
So you first of all have the stillness and then you come into this conversation.
Yeah, that's right. Stillness remains still at the heart of the conversation, and there's both the stillness and the conversation continually in relationship with each other.
And it's really fast too, because it happens in a second.
Oh, in a second, microsecond, totally.
Yes. Yeah.
No, that's the point. That's the point. Things are not as solid as we think they are. They're just very fast processes. So when the Buddha says, you know, the self is a ring of fire created by a burning torch spun very fast in the middle of the night, he's describing the whole structure of the universe. Things that appear solid are not solid, but they're very fast. So because they're so fast, they appear solid. But actually, they are very fast conversations.
And is there a sense that we can feel and hold those both at the same time? So we can also be that centre and feel that centre, but also feel that expansion as we kind of connect and it comes through.
Yeah, we can. Yeah.
About holding the two at the same time.
Well, yes, but it's more relaxing into it, right? Rather, not so much, like, because if you're trying to hold, you rigidify. So you have to relax into both that sense of stillness and the movement. This is something that T.S. Eliot writes very powerfully about in the Four Quartets, when he talks about the stillness and the movement. You know, so it's definitely, you know, he describes that absolutely beautifully, really.
It could bring us back into the present moment very quickly, I think, because it's so fast. You need to be very aware of what's happening right now.
Yeah.
Get that flavour of what it is.
No, completely. That's why the body and the senses are so important here, because you know, our minds go all over the place, obviously. But the thing that's great about our bodies, when we pay attention, they're always operating in present time. That's why the body is the great anchor here somewhere.
And I'm thinking about after I've done a gong bath, and then I always have to go and sit down and sort of come back to myself.
Yeah.
But the other day, I had a group here and I had to go and get the oven on. So I went straight from the gong bath to the kitchen. And I got into such a difficult space. And when people started coming in and speaking to me, I couldn't cope with it because I hadn't given myself that time to come back into my body.
Yeah. No, I think, well, in a sense, you see, to be in that, if we think of you in that position, Jen, you're acting as a magician. So when you're holding a gong bath or somebody, you're literally being the magician. Okay, you're standing in that position, and it comes through you, as well as the gongs, it comes through you, because you're working the gongs, you're doing it. So what happens then is you're stuck in between, so you haven't enough time to come back to yourself. So you're stuck between that kind of very open, energetically open, very present to the larger universe self, and then you've got somebody talking to you about food or something, you know, and it just scrambles everything, really. So that's why the emergence out of that and coming back into your kind of, like, a more ordinary sense of self to mediate whatever's coming next is actually kind of quite important.
That's really helpful.
Good. Okay, let's have a half hour break for a cup of tea, and we'll see what comes next. Okay, see you in a moment.
Thanks.